Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Dialing for dollars is trying to find me. I wait for delivery each day until 3. So, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? I'm counting on you, Lord. Please don't let me down. Prove that you love me and buy the next round. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? Everybody, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz?
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear us at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. Coming up next, the UN Climate Change Reports as Haiku. The reports of the United Nations Panel on Climate Change are critically important but notoriously dense. IPCC scientist Gregory Johnson tells Steve Curwood about his personal project to write haiku poems to make the reports more understandable. And then, after that, John Gray gives two cheers for human rights. John Gray argues that rather than thinking of rights as a militant creed that can deliver the world from its conflicts, we should recognize rights for what they are, useful devices that quite often don't work.
The periodic assessments from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, rely on a couple of thousand scientists from around the world. They produce a detailed appraisal of humanity's impact on the climate and what it means now and in the future. These reports are notoriously dense and hard to read. Well, NOAA scientist Greg Johnson was a lead author for part of the assessment published last fall, and he's come up with a simple, elegant way to communicate the complex scientific findings, haiku.
Seas rise as they warm. Rates quicken last century. Melting ice joins in.
Oceanographer Gregory Johnson joins me now to share more of these IPCC haikus. Welcome to Living on Earth, Greg.
Hi, thanks, Steve.
So how did you come up with this idea, IPCC as haiku?
Well, actually, I was sick one weekend, and I was really sick enough to be unable to leave the house. And so I was trying to figure out what I would do for the weekend. And for some reason, I thought I would reread the summary for policymakers from the working group one report to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That's the one on the physical science basis of climate change. And like you said, they are very dense documents. And so I was reading this, and I was having trouble concentrating.
Wait, you'd worked on this. You knew it was supposed to be there, and you couldn't stay focused?
Well, I was sick. But anyways, I thought it would help fix it in my mind if I tried to compose a haiku for each of the subsections of the report. But I sat down and I composed these haiku. It took most of the morning and a little bit past lunch. And then my wife said, "What on earth are you doing?" I think she was. And at that point, I sort of thought, well, what am I doing? And I realized that I could make them into a little illustrated booklet to share with friends and family if I added some illustrations.
So you're an oceanographer for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and you're a lead author for the working group chapter on oceans. But this is not any kind of official document.
That's correct. These are solely my own creation. Any views or opinions expressed in these are my own and do not necessarily reflect those of the United States government, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or any other entity.
So these poems basically go in order of the bullet points for the report. Will you read the first point as haiku, please? It's called History, Earth.
That's right. Big fast carbon surge. Ice melts, oceans heat and rise, air warms by decades.
So that's essentially the recent history of the Earth's climate in 17 syllables, huh?
That's right.
So remind us of the rules of haiku.
So the rules in English are different from the rules in Japanese, but the strict rules are of a syllable count of 5, 7, 5 in the three lines. They're supposed to be a reference to the season. And the Japanese have specific words for these, I think. These don't necessarily have references to seasons in them, but they do have references to change in climate. And I thought that'd give me a pass on that. And then they're also supposed to have what the Japanese call a cutting word, sort of a transition. And not all of these do have that, actually, but they do all follow the 5-7-5 rule.
Now, will you read two more for us that are closely related? They're called response and attribution.
Yes. The first one is response. We burn more carbon. Air warms for decades, but seas for millennia. And then attribution. Our industry has warmed oceans, air, lands, changed rains, melted ice, raised seas.
It's incredible how so few words can be so powerful. What got you going with haiku?
I post almost exclusively in haiku on Facebook. I find that it helps me be in the present. It tends to link my posts a little more closely to nature and what's going on around me. And it also limits the number of posts, which my friends probably like.
Now, it seems that all of your poems are accompanied by a watercolor painting. The last one about industry goes along with a painting of an oil rig. There's another with a painting of windmills on a rolling hill. Will you read that, please?
Let's see. Fast, strong action will reduce future warming, but rising seas certain.
So, Greg, what kind of responses have you gotten so far from this project?
They've really been quite positive. But I have to say, actually, it took some time on my part to get up the courage to put this out there. This is, of course, a distillation of, as you said, work of 209 lead authors, 50 review editors, 1,000 expert reviewers. So a huge amount of work went into this. But the response actually to the haiku have been remarkably positive.
What kind of response have you gotten from your IPCC co-authors?
They enjoy it. I did make a number of little booklets on my own dime and have given them to friends and colleagues and authors. And it's been a positive response from them as well.
You ran out of the booklets?
Pretty much, yeah.
What's your publisher say?
I don't have a publisher. These were all self-published. I can't actually profit from these in any way because they are related to my work. And that's just one of the rules of my employer.
Well, we're just about out of time, Greg, but I wonder if you'd read one final haiku for us, perhaps the one that you titled Future.
All right. 40 years from now, children will live in a world shaped by our choices.
Greg, you have children?
I have a daughter.
Who's how old?
She is 17 now.
So when she's 57?
The world will be a very different place, I think, and it will depend on what choices we make. We're living in a world now that's already shaped by our choices.
Greg Johnson is a NOAA oceanographer and lead author of the Working Group 1 report chapter on oceans. Thanks so much for taking the time with us today.
Oh, thank you.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Today, there is a growing number of men and women hunters with a problem. The problem is, they carry guns.
Oh my God, I shot off my big toe!
No, you didn't. You shot off mine.
Oh, sorry.
NRAA is here to help with our 12-step program.
The fact is, Merle, you just can't carry a gun anymore.
But I wanted to go hunting tomorrow.
Okay, let's say you go hunting tomorrow, you forget your gun is loaded, and you shoot yourself in the foot again. How is that going to feel?
Well, it'll hurt.
Step one is admitting that you have a problem.
Hi, my name is Merle, and I haven't shot myself in over a week.
Hi, Merle.
NRAA. Keep coming back. It works.
Ow! I shot my toe.
Sometimes.
The speaker is John Gray.
When we hear reports of nightmarish atrocities being committed in Syria, it's easy to respond by thinking these horrors could be prevented if only the country had a government that respected human rights. We've come to believe rights are the answer to many of the world's ills. But rights aren't a cure for human conflict, and I think it's a mistake to treat them as an article of faith. In an essay published in 1938, the novelist E.M. Forster gave 2 cheers for democracy. 1, because it admits variety, and 2, because it permits criticism. 2 cheers are quite enough, he wrote. There is no occasion to give 3. Forster thought that no political system, not even democracy, should be turned into an icon. What mattered, he thought, was that individuals should have the chance to live as best they can. On this, Forster was right. While democracy is a good thing, as anyone will tell you who's experienced the alternatives, it isn't something we should worship, and it shouldn't be a creed we try to impose on the world. But what Forster argued about democracy is also true of human rights today. From providing a useful safeguard against the abuse of power, human rights are turning into a comforting dogma through which we try to escape the painful dilemmas of war and politics. Human rights have two large virtues. They empower us against governments, and anyone can claim them. If we have rights, we needn't approach power on our knees as supplicants begging for favors. We can demand that our freedoms be respected. And it doesn't matter who governs us. Human rights can be invoked wherever they exist. For many people, the universality of rights is their principal attraction, but for me, it's also their chief weakness. John Locke, the 17th century English thinker who founded the modern theory of rights, believed rights were grounded in our duties to God. For him, human freedom was divinely ordained. That's why he believed we don't have the right to commit suicide or to sell ourselves into slavery. In Locke's view, we always remain God's creatures. Nowadays, many believers in rights are indifferent or hostile to religion. The fact remains that human rights originated in monotheism, the belief that there's only one God who creates a single moral law for all human beings. And there's a sense in which human rights still depend on some sort of religious commitment. For unless these rights are grounded in something beyond the human world, they can only be a human invention. As someone without any religious beliefs, that's a conclusion I'm happy to accept. But it has uncomfortable consequences for those who think human rights have universal authority. It's one thing to say there are universal human values, a view I strongly endorse. Some things are bad for everyone, being subject to the threat of torture or persecution, for example. But human beings have devised a variety of ways of fending off these universal evils, and rights haven't always been the most reliable or effective. A highly developed culture of rights in the United States didn't stop torture being regarded by some as a legitimate weapon in the so-called War on Terror, for example. We've forgotten that rights aren't the only way to protect universal values. For several centuries, the Ottoman Empire was a haven where religious minorities that were persecuted in Christian countries could live together in peace. The Ottoman regime wasn't based on rights. In fact, since it involved separate systems of law for each community, it was incompatible with a system in which everyone has the same rights. Where something like peace between religions has been achieved, it's because the difficult art of toleration has been learned. Where it's deeply rooted, the practice of tolerance is a more reliable safeguard against persecution than any code of rights. The European Convention on Human Rights was incorporated into UK law only in 1998, but Britain, despite all its flaws, has a better historical record of respecting human freedom than many European states. The elaborate system of rights that was embodied in the Weimar Republic didn't stem the rise of Nazism. Human rights can't defend anyone when the state that upholds them is swept away. Many people seem to think that once tyranny is demolished, human rights will emerge naturally from the rubble. But rights are artifacts of civilization, not a natural human condition. If they protect us against the state, they're also created and enforced by states. Where the state is weak or collapsed, as in many parts of the world today, human rights simply don't exist. It's consoling to believe that horrendous cruelty in Syria could be stopped by deposing the dictator and ending the war. In fact, if Assad were toppled at this point, the most likely result would be a country without any state at all that was stuck in a condition of chronic war. That's pretty much what has happened in Libya, where even the prime minister isn't safe from kidnap by armed gangs. If a new state could be installed in such conditions, it's not clear it would be one that respected human rights. Rights are like money and the law. They only exist if enough people accept that they exist. But what if large sections of the population, or those that are most ruthless in imposing their values, don't accept them? What if many people don't want human rights? For believers in rights, the answer is that everyone really does want them. Or if they don't, they can be persuaded to want them. The similarity between this view and that of religious evangelists is obvious and striking. Evangelists are convinced that all that's needed for humankind to see the light is that it should be shown to them. Once they've seen the true faith, everyone will embrace it. If there are some who don't accept the saving gospel, as will surely be the case, the mission must continue until they do. Believers in human rights think the same. Both are engaged in an unending project of conversion. It's not surprising that human rights movements should exhibit some of the attributes of evangelical religion. Like other secular creeds, they're continuations of proselytizing monotheism by other means. The certainty of rights advocates that only one type of state can be legitimate continues the conviction that only one way of life can be good. In their different ways, evangelical religion and human rights movements express the perennial dream of a life without irreconcilable conflicts. But human life, as we know it, is made up of conflicts of this kind, and politics is very often a choice among evils. This isn't only because every society is bound to be less than perfect. It's because we lack any coherent idea of what a perfect society would actually be like. A world in which all rights are protected isn't just impracticable. It's not even conceivable. Freedom of expression is a good thing, but so is protection from hate speech. We all want to be free to voice our views without fear, but we also want to be free from being insulted or stigmatized. The two freedoms will always be at odds, for they protect different and competing human interests. Both are universal human values, but they'll never be reconciled in any kind of harmonious whole. The ideal of a world ruled by rights distracts us from an unalterable reality. We'll always be mired in dangerous and only partly soluble conflicts. Human rights can't get round the fact that human values are at odds with one another. The freedom from conflict that many people seek in rights is just an illusion. This doesn't mean rights should be scrapped. Like the religion from which they sprang, they're a valuable part of the human inheritance. But rather than thinking of rights as a militant creed that can deliver the world from its conflicts, we should recognize rights for what they are, useful devices that quite often don't work. Following E.M. Forster, we should give human rights a rousing two cheers.
A Point of View is written and presented by John Gray. The producer was Sheila Cook. And there are many more programmes to download for free at bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Jim and John are my cousin, had no place to go. There ain't nobody higher around here since all the jobs down in Mexico. I reckon that learning self-trade made me see the world. Moved to the city someday, married a black haired girl. Somebody somewhere had another plan. Now he's got a rifle in his hand, rolling in a bag and wondering how he got this far. Just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war. Bobby had an eagle and a flag tattooed on his arm. Red, white, and blue to the bone with a land in Kandahar. I left behind a pretty young wife and a baby girl. A stack of overdue bills and went off to save the world. Been a year now, he's still here, chasing ghosts in thin dry air. We went back at home to find us, come and took his car. He's just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war.
Now, as you know, the negative ads have been, well, extreme this year. So in hopes of bringing some civility to this election season, we're pleased to welcome you to tonight's first presidential debate. So let's get right to it. Please welcome President Barack Obama and Republican candidate Mitt Romney. Mr. President, I'm sorry we had to trick you into coming by telling you this was a Hollywood fundraiser.
Brian, it's okay. I actually have raised $9 million tonight anyway. Before the show in the green room, I went through Mitt Romney's pockets.
Now, Mr. Romney, as you know, some polls have shown both you and Mr. Obama trailing a third candidate, none of the above. In polls, some people say they don't like your personality.
That's highly insulting. I don't have a personality.
Okay, well, we've allotted each candidate 90 seconds to answer the same question. To determine the order, we're going to toss a coin. Mr. Romney, heads or tails?
What's a coin? Is that anything like a bilateral unfunded credit default derivative?
Okay, Mr. President, you'll go first.
Wait, before you ask me that question, will someone turn on my teleprompter? Okay.
Okay, Mr. President. First question, why did the chicken cross the road?
Well, Brian, first, let me say that this chicken could not have crossed the road on his own. This road was built with stimulus money. And I would say that if the chicken laid an egg while crossing this government-funded road, I would say to that chicken, you didn't build that egg. You had some help. So I'm very glad to be able to share my position on this chicken. Now, Mr. Romney's attacks on my chicken statements have made me very angry. I'm sorry for that outburst. And one more thing. Perhaps this chicken crossed the road because he was afraid to release his tax returns. Perhaps this chicken crossed the road to get to the Cayman Islands.
Are we still talking about a chicken?
Mr. Romney, same question. Why did the chicken cross the road?
I've had one position on this chicken all along. Did the chicken cross the road? Yes. Did it get to the other side? No. Do we know why it crossed the road? Yes. Do we know why it never got to the other side? No. So I don't think I can be any clearer than that.
Okay, Mr. Obama, 30 seconds for rebuttal.
Let me say that if Mr. Romney got his way, this chicken wouldn't be able to cross the road at all because he'd be outsourced to India, and the only road he'd be crossing would be the road to become chicken tandoori.
Now that's highly insulting because I love chickens. As a matter of fact, I love all birds.
Okay, Mr. Romney, next question. How many Democrats do you believe it would take to change a light bulb?
You need at least five. You need one to insist on it being an energy-efficient CFL, one to approve a $535 million grant to a startup company to develop a new light bulb, one to flush that $535 million grant down the drain, one to file a lawsuit claiming that all light bulbs are toxic, and Al Gore to claim that incandescent light bulbs are destroying the habitat of the Galapagos sea turtle.
Mr. Obama.
Let me be clear. Let me be perfectly clear. You would need three Mitt Romneys. One to change the bulb. One to take a poll on that bulb. And one to change the bulb back after the poll results came back. But I don't think Republicans would change the bulb at all because it's obvious that they prefer to live in the dark.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. And the winner of tonight's debate, anyone with a remote control. Good night.
To call out, would you touch me? Hey you, would you help me to carry the stone? Open your heart, I'm coming home.
That's all, folks.